Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian who survived a coma, and on this show, I talk to artists and organizers about death, art, politics, and the events that define our lives. My guest this week is Keir Nuringer, saxophonist for Irreversible Entanglements, and his own improv trio, I believe a trio, Dromedaries, who released a new album this year. They released an album with a sci-fi writer and vocalist, Alex Oterik, and it is an out there fucking futurist. Listen, I'm not going to say, here's what I'm going to do. One of the song titles is Hermes Majesty 3.0 Firmware Safe Injection Site, or How I Learned to Love the Demiurge. Okay, so that's what the album is, you know? It's great. I had a great time talking to Keir. This is an intense one. I love doing this show, partially for the fact that the tone varies wildly from episode to episode. And this was an intense one, and I expected that, because part of the thing that drew me to want to talk to Keir in the first place was the righteousness with which he posts about the genocide in Palestine. And he is still doing that, because that ceasefire is bullshit. It has not been a ceasefire. Israel continues to fucking bomb and kill in all sorts of horrible ways, Gazans and other Palestinians. And yeah, if you listen to the show, you know that speaking to the horrors of the world has been really important to me, and gives me a kind of comfort. So I hope you find the same comfort that I do in listening to this episode. I also want to let you know, I don't run ads. The support comes from Patreon. If you give me $5 a month, which, man, is really so little dollars a month, but you get a premium feed with bonus episodes on the off weeks. You also get all of these episodes on TIYA After Dark, which is what that bonus feed is. Most recently, I talked to Matt Sage of Fubitsushi of the This Is Your Afterlife artwork about our love for CDs. It's just 2 hours of CD nerds talking about CDs. So if that sounds exciting to you, go over there and join the Patreon. For 15 bucks a month, you become a posthumous producer. Those people get their names shouted out, and they are Katie Llewellyn, Fred Fidowa, Shubha Singh, G, and Debo. So thank you to them. Thank you to you for listening. And here is Keir Nuringer and me. Did you take a look at those questions that I sent via email?
I did.
Cool.
I did.
No need to have prepped anything, but sorry, what were you going to say?
No, it's fine. I'm an improviser.
Yes. Yes.
So.
Well, that will be our, does it work? Well, I mean, I guess the theater performance artist way of referring to improvisation that I know of is to call it a score. So that's a, you know, you're working from a musical term, but what are you working from when you're improvising? Cause there are melodies, there are tunes in the Irreversible Entanglements stuff.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that band is a subset of what I do.
Yeah.
And it's really determined by the five of us, not, any one of us. You know, in my work, I like when you're like, what are you working from? Like in terms of like score, like what are the rules or what's the frame or
yes.
something is. Yeah. It depends. It depends on, the place and the project and the audience. And, you know, so sometimes we're playing a tune, you know, with some people like Irreversible Entanglements or like another group that I might be in, right? We're playing a tune. Sometimes we are improvising a tune, and that we also determines like the parameters, people's capabilities or their like proclivities or whatever you want to say. If I'm playing solo, which I do a lot, that's a whole other set of rules, right? And then And then if I'm composing for a theater, you know, I'm at home, I'm writing music, I'm recording it, and then I'm, you know, bringing it to the director. Let's put this with on, you know, on this scene or whatever. So it depends. It depends. I don't know how exciting it is.
In what way? What do you mean?
I don't know how exciting it is, like the technical the technical details of what I do. I don't know who would get fired up by that outside of a classroom.
Are you talking
You know?
about, are you now like worried about who would be listening to this and would be excited about it? Is that where that is coming from?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest that speaking of like the score and the parameters and the frame, I know that we are having this conversation because people will listen to it, right? And I think that the observer and the audience matters.
For sure.
Like, it concerns me. Well, you saying for sure as though it was a universal, and I'm sure you and I know plenty of creative people who create not because of an engagement with observers, an audience, but because of their own need, right? I mean, I
Yeah.
can say that another way. Like,
No. I understand. I'm just wondering because I think coming from comedy, my for sure is a lot more of a given. I think the thing you're talking about is because literally the room sounds different if you're doing comedy and people aren't responding to it. People aren't laughing. People aren't you know, or they that you're hearing such silence that you're hearing shifting in chairs or coughs or whatever.
I mean, you're talking about live comedy, you
Yes,
know,
yes, yes, yes.
right? And that makes sense, you know, to me. There's also like writing a joke that you know is funny, right? That
True,
like,
true.
or writing a scene, you know, or developing a character,
Right.
right? That I imagine is different than like going for the laughs and not bombing, right?
Yes. There's an awareness of audience from the origin and in the intent is what you're saying.
I mean, I'm just, yeah, I don't care to dis I like yeah I'm in discourse with like an audience, with a public, right? That's my concern. You know, like, you know, the concept of this podcast and like is could be with like a therapist, right? Very
Sure.
private,
Sure.
super private, right? Those like, you know, but it's not, it's super public, it's online for whoever bumps into it, right? Your crowd and mine. So yeah, I am thinking about what I am saying to people, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I ask because I find that technical stuff fascinating. I think it's very interesting and maybe not interesting in and of itself, but I find that I come to life when people ask really specific stuff about craft. And I think frequently other people come to life when they have those sort of things to talk about. And it's that liveliness that I'm interested in, almost even more than like, you know, what the exact notation looks like. But I find that in the specifics, there is, you know, you can map on a musical score to, you know, whatever your fucking marketing job, maybe even.
So, did you ask me to have this conversation because of something about my technique that sparked your interest?
No.
Right. I have a shit ton of technique and a shit ton of thoughts behind it, and like why I do it and how it's developed over, you know, a lifetime of, you know, yeah, developing my craft, whatever. And I mean, who wants to hear about that at a fucking time like this?
Yeah.
You know, like I, and that's, and that, but that's been my thing for 20, 25 years is like, it's been a time like this, you know? Like,
yeah.
You know? And so I'm like, I could talk about it and then hate myself for talking about it.
No, and I'm not interested in making you hate yourself, but I am interested in, you know, the reason I hit you up to do, and why I felt like this would be a good conversation for the show. I mean, remains to be seen, but is you publicly expressing a struggle that I feel between creating, making work, in your case, music, that is like, and how to do that, and what function that has at a time like this, as you say. And I'm curious because you've been playing for more than 25 years, right?
Yeah.
So was that this principle, the political like importance of your work, is that something that kind of snapped into place with that, or was that always in place like from the beginning of making music?
Wow. I think it started to materialize as like explicitly political around 2001. And I think before that it was a attitude toward the world and the audience that was like a little bit more, you know, maybe confrontational. Mm-hmm. But it sort of became explicit for me, and the need to be explicit around 2001. And, you know, it's gone through a lot of phases and it's developed and it's matured, I hope, and it's focused. But it's always there, even when it's not explicit.
Yeah. Is 2001, I mean, is it 9/11 that we're talking about, or is there something else in 2001?
I 9/11 was a big part of it. Right, a couple weeks before 9/11. So I had been, quick bio recap.
Hell yeah.
I moved to Poland in 1999, and I lived in Poland for 2 years, learned the language, made music, developed, made lifelong friends, like family. It was a big, big part of my life. And then the end of the summer of 2001, I moved to the Netherlands to keep studying music. And at the time, for me, the difference between Krakow and The Hague were like opposite sides of the spectrum in terms of culture and social life and, you know,
which side
lay of
which?
The land. Would you know, the Netherlands are flat, right? Poland is wavy. The Netherlands, you know, rich country. Poland was like a poor country, right? Poland was like Slavic and super expressive and super emotional and sentimental, and the Netherlands was you know, the opposite of all that. You know, I think of the paintings of Mondrian as like a really good example of like what it felt like to be in the Netherlands. Mm, okay. And, you know, I tend to be a more sentimental person, and I, you know, Poland had, I really embraced it as like a second home. So anyway, I get to the Netherlands at the end of August, 2001. And within like 3 weeks, 9/11 happens, and also my apartment got broken into and I got robbed and everything got taken, like my laptop with all of my work, of a, you know, that I was working on, like music and shit. and my rent money and, you know, like my whole place got turned upside down. It never happened to me before. Oh, and also I'm forgetting one other detail is that when I was in Poland, I was on a Fulbright grant.
Okay.
It was so well compensated. It was embarrassing, like better than like my professor. You know what I mean? It was like very well compensated. And I was, enjoyed that. And I got to the Netherlands and student loans from my undergrad in the States became due, you know? Mm-hmm. I didn't have like a visa to work. All that stuff kind of happened at the same time. Be fair to call it like a breakdown, that fall. My music changed and my attitude toward the world changed.
Was the change?
People point to like the moment of radicalization, you know, and I think it'd be fair to describe, my response to the United States response to 9/11 as the thing, like the thing that radicalized me. Of course, like I could also point to like the books I was reading and I was able to be at that time online a lot more than I had been in Poland. And online was becoming a different thing in 2001 than it was, you know, in the previous years. And it was a different thing to me as well, suddenly like there's like, whatever, this is annoying to say, but like there's Chomsky, you know, in front of me, like, and you know, all these writers and, you know, Arundhati Roy and, you know, I'm of the generation where we all had No Logo on the shelf. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I read it.
Yeah.
You know, I read all these books and shifted in my thinking. It was like a tough transition. It was a really tough transition. I was down, you know.
Yeah.
Over all that shit.
And how does it filter into the work?
I had this, I started to feel that at that time, you know, I'm like 25, 2001, I started to feel that, all artistic output should speak to the times in which it's being made. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was dropping the pretense of like legacy, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, you know, because I was trained as a composer, right? You know, gray-haired white European men on the wall, right?
Right. The canon,
yeah. And wanting to like somehow situate myself in that lineage while also being like this saxophone player who was like playing free improv, like, you know, really out shit, like coming out of playing jazz and funk in high school, but like really figuring out that I wanted to play really out stuff, but also dealing with this baggage of European classical music, right?
Well, there's a canon of titans with the really out saxophone players.
I was figuring that out.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And so at any rate, yeah, how does it manifest in the music? I say, all the music should speak to the time in which it's made. I was thinking a lot about like Orwell and Camus and just trying to assert presence in the public spaces where my music was presented. It's 2001, 2002, 2003. We're not in this space here in The Hague, in Europe, in like a conservatory setting or, you know, a contemporary art setting. We are not fucking gonna forget that, like, we're, that Afghanistan is being bombed to rubble right now. We're not gonna forget that, you know, we're about to go to war with Iraq, or we've just started a war with Iraq. And that kind of positioned me with respect to my peers, right? Like, I was really insistent in all of my social situations that, like, this is central, right? Fucking now, you know, cities are being turned into rubble in our name, right? It was around the time, it was right at the time when Saul Williams and a bunch of other people did that Not in Our Name manifesto, which was, I was like an early signer of that. I sent them money, like, let's get this printed. They were printing it in the New York Times. Like, it was, you know, a lot of what's happened over the last 25 years is like, speaks to that. You've seen that like protest sign where like, I can't believe we're still protesting this shit, you know, and like, so much since 2001, 2002, 2003 has just felt like repetition.
Yeah.
You know, like, how are we still having the same public discourse over, you know, like the commitment to cruelty on this grand scale, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I'm thinking about this shit all the time as like 25, 26, 27 year old. And I'm also there to study music. What the fuck? So like, it's I'm just building it into, you know, trial and error, right? Like, I don't, at that age, like, I don't know everything. I don't know everything that everyone has done, right? I'm trying to figure it out for myself. So like, is it about how we name pieces of music? Is it how like we put words into pieces of music? Is it how we arrange ourselves on stage, present ourselves on stage, present ourselves in the space, you know, create conflict in the performance? Is it the way we, you know, push against like I didn't have this language for it then, but like the colonial nature of the canon, or the canons, right? Is every piece a fundraiser for some shit? Like,
right,
a lot of like, so a lot of my attempts, some of them were, you know, some of them were fine. Some of them were really beautiful and effective. And some of them were heavy handed, you know? And I think that's probably still the case, you know, like,
sure.
You know, but you know, I think I figured out pretty quickly that like, this is who I am and who I'm going to be,
you know? And so I assume it's more complicated than just, oh, of the things I just mentioned, it's these three things. That's how to fuse the politics with the music. But are there more and less effective methods of doing that you found?
Probably. I think if you had asked me that question 10 years ago, it would have been easier to answer. At this point, I feel, you know, there's been a lot of work, and it's harder for me to survey everything.
Yeah.
Over the last like 2.5 decades. You know, I feel, so I'll tell you what I'm doing lately.
Yes.
Partially out of need and, you know, circumstance, and partially out of choice. But, you know, I live in Ithaca, New York. It's pretty isolated. You know, it's a 4-hour drive from New York or Philly, where I used to live. It's not on any major highways. It's not like a major tour stop. There's not a huge scene for creative music here. There are no venues really. it's tough, right? And my major income in the music has been through Irreversible Entanglements. And, you know, we're working on a record right now, so there's not a lot of touring going on. We're going to play again in the fall. So it's like a slow time, right? Feast or famine is always like, you know, the thing in this business. But I've been setting up these shows at a record store in the back, Angry Mom Records. It's a great place. Love that place. And they've been generous to host these nights where, I don't know, we'll get 25, 35, 50 people maybe. We had a lot of people show up when Sarah Henny's played those vibes behind me.
Okay.
So I have a small audience and I get to kind of do anything I want, like show up with whatever instruments I want. And I don't think I'm experimenting, but I think I'm just like allowing for a lot of the moment to determine what happens. And a thing that I've been doing lately is I have all of these saw blades. They're like, I'm showing you, they're like,
you like know, circular like saw blades.
Circular saw blades.
Yeah.
And they sound beautiful. They're like, they play them like gongs. And some of them are very, very sharp. Right. And so a bunch of times I've taken all these saw blades and I walk into the audience and I hand saw blades. I've rigged them up so that they're hanging on something that doesn't dampen the sound. And I hand everyone a saw blade and like a hammer or a drumstick or whatever. And I have everybody play like it's we're all like wind chimes together.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we get it going and it's just a beautiful sound. Right. And it's in the space and everybody's locked in to me, to each other, right. To the moment. And then I can play saxophone as, you know, as complicated or as simple as I want, depending on what the moment is speaking to me. And, you know, the performance and the piece will end when it ends. And I've said this explicitly a couple times, and other times I've, you know, I felt like it's implicit, but after the show and everybody's handing back these gongs that are saw blades is that we are now organized, right? We've entered into like an ability to work together and communicate with each other beyond words. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And also everyone in the room is fucking armed.
Yeah. Yeah.
With something that will kill a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, And you know, often when I perform solo, I will read like some text that I've written, or occasionally I'll read the text that is meaningful that someone else has written. And then that's an opportunity to make things really explicit.
Yeah.
But also there's that in a way that becomes like an implicit thing. You know, my need to really connect with the audience and to like say like your time is going to be the time you give to this is going to be worthwhile and meaningful. And, you know, the opportunity for it to be transcendent of like the, you know, the social conventions of a gig are there. Doesn't mean it's going to happen for everybody. Doesn't mean I'm going to be able to like get there every time,
mm-hmm.
but I'm thinking about like, how do we do that in some way and just like break out, you know, I also have to acknowledge my own, I guess preferences or whatever. Like, I don't want to go out onto the street and play my saxophone.
Yeah.
You know, I want to play for the people, but I don't want to like walk out on the street and like do that. You know, I don't think it's the best use of the way that I engage people. I want us to like sit down and look each other in the eyes and connect, you know?
Yeah, I totally know. I mean, I think the thing that is exciting to me about what you're saying, or the thing that I still am struggling with in my own non-podcast work, in the live performance work, which is rare because I mask indoors and don't have a lot of opportunities to perform live that I feel safe in. Mm-hmm. But is the explicitness versus the implicitness? I kind of like growing up evangelical, there was everything was explicit. It was like the message, you know, you listen to the worst music because it's Christian music, you know? And so I reacted against that for so long and like valued aesthetics for its own sake. The idea that, as fucking Johnny Greenwood wrote in a recent statement, that our art transcends politics. You know, I believed that.
Fuck that guy.
Yes, absolutely. Fuck that guy. And fuck that sentiment as well.
Yeah.
But now I struggle with the idea that the implicit is more valuable than the explicit. That if you're being explicit with a message, you're explaining things, you're dumbing it down, you are flattening the artistic part for the sake of the message. And I wonder if you struggle with that or have struggled with that.
Well, yeah, that gets to the like the heavy-handed stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a story I've told a lot from back when I was in the Netherlands studying. I had left the composition department. I'd sort of been like encouraged by the faculty to leave the department, basically because I was like trying to focus on improvisation and performance and, you know, confronting the audience with my politics rather than like the craft of composition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't a match. Okay. So I moved on. I stayed in the Netherlands and I moved on to this, at the time it was called the Interfaculty of Image and Sound. It was started by some guys who were interested in synesthesia. Mm-hmm. While I was there, it changed into the Art Science Institute, I think, because art science was like a term that could like get funding or something. I don't know. Like none of the students were consulted. We didn't like art science as like that. That's not what I felt that I was studying. But I was like engaged in this like cross-disciplinary art study and art making. And again, I was, you know, our department would be sitting once a week or whatever, all together. And I would, kept saying to people, and it was really international crowd. Mm-hmm. And I kept insisting, like, why aren't we making more political work? Why is everyone here not making more political work? Think about what's going on in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq or, you know, Yemen or like this place or that place. And I kept pushing. And eventually one of my peers who was from Serbia, was like, I was in art school in Belgrade in 1999 when your fucking country was bombing the shit out of my city. And I was in a basement like that whole time with like your bombs falling overhead. And we didn't want to make art about politics. We wanted to paint flowers, you know, because we didn't have access to flowers, right?
Yeah.
It's April, right? And, you know, we're in a bunker because of what your country was doing. And it really hit me. And, I, you know, I'll say that, like, that person, like, did make political work, I think. But at the time I wasn't grasping it because it wasn't explicit in the way that I wanted something to be explicit. Right. And so I think about that moment a lot. And also just in getting older, I think about how, you know, none of the work is universal. Humor is not universal, right? And I don't think this is for everybody. Is like, first of all, it denies like that, like our differences are beautiful and exciting, and that like I don't get it where I'm coming from. That doesn't track, right? Like that doesn't. So for some of us, like the painting of a flower is political, right? In some circumstance. And for some of us, the painting of a flower is so anti-political, so devoid of politics, that it becomes the enemy of like a politics of like liberation.
Yeah.
Right. And in another sense, that flower is liberation, you know, does represent liberation. So, and so I think in kind of growing with and grappling with all this shit, like trying to navigate the reality that you're not like the universal is pretty elusive, you know. And I think there's something to be said for grace, like being a little bit more open to the possibility of what someone's intention might be.
Because when you're saying that, I'm hearing, well, I'm just, it's coming up for me that it can be very difficult to tell which flower is the political flower and which flower is not the political flower. And frequently, especially in America, especially white people, there is this movement of self-care, self-preservation that pretends to be about saving yourself for the struggle, but can be taken so far that it's like, oh, which just makes the line super, super blurry. And for you to say practicing grace is important, what that makes me think is that it's not my job to determine which flower is political and which flower is not political. Is that, am I close to where you're at?
I think the way you said it back to me makes me think of two things. One is that like a lot of that self-care shit is appropriation.
I think I know what you mean, but say more. Yeah.
Appropriation from people who are like living under the boot of white cruelty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who figured out that like self-care is a way to stay in the fight. What is the fucking fight of like suburban, like comfortable white people that they need to be so focused on self-care? What's that? What are they liberating themselves from? Like it, like that's the appropriation. I mean, right.
Yeah.
So that on the one hand, and then, the other thing that what you said brings up for me is like, I've been thinking a lot for years. And my thinking evolves. And I think it's so important right now is that in the United States, people are so consumed with binary thinking in all ways, right? So is that flower political or apolitical? Right now, I need to know how to categorize it, how to box it, to ship it and sell it, right? Like, and everything is like, is that spiritual jazz or is that like free improv or is that like, is that, or is it like, and it drives me crazy. And I think it like all of it's on purpose, you know, in some way. Like I need to know what's like under your pants, right? Mm-hmm. Like that whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. I need to know like what are you? How are you categorized? You know, are like, you know, are you good or bad? Is it good or bad? Is it plus or minus? Like these, it's painted our culture into such a tight corner that we're super fucked because people can't get out of this thinking. And, you know, I like as much as I spend every day thinking about it and trying to disabuse myself of it, I also find myself thinking like, well, there goes a pickup truck with a Blue Lives Matter sticker on it.
Yeah.
I hope that person drives off a cliff and dies.
Yeah.
Well, like, what if like the person driving that pickup just killed the owner, you know, or like, I don't know, that's fucked up. Like, right. What if it's their kid? Right. What if they just got that car and someone threw that sticker on it? Like, who knows? Right.
Yeah.
But also like, I can't help feeling my feelings and like, it, you know, just seeing that shit just like enrages me. And it's like, to the extent that the rage like changes how my day goes, how that moment goes for me, like they got in my head, and that's because my thinking was really binary in that moment. Blue Lives Matter sticker make me angry.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Like
I've been having that with Tesla Cybertrucks. Oh, I had made it because it's my frustration with the inability of some people to change has led me to think that maybe it's important to just make some people uncomfortable. And so I had kind of developed this belief that may I can extend some grace to other Teslas, but if you drive a Cybertruck, I'm going to be honking and flipping you off the entire time that you're in my vision. And then I was on a road trip, like driving back from Pittsburgh. It was like a 2-hour drive. And I had like, you know, spent a weekend with some friends. And I saw a couple and I didn't want to go to the effort of disturbing my own peace to do that. And that made very clear the corrosion of those sorts of efforts on me personally. Let's take a detour into the questions I sent you that the podcast tends to usually revolve around.
Right on.
But this is the podcast too. Like it's your work and your thoughts are why I'm interested in talking to you. So we have to get, you know, we have to get to the starting point, if that makes sense. What do you hope happens when you die?
Well, I've read your questions. And so everything we've said so far, for me, it was like with those questions in mind, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess in a way, talking about all this stuff was in hopes that we would run out of time and not have to talk about what do I hope happens when I die. Because, you know, the question I ask myself is, do I hope anything happens when I die? Do I even want to do I want to negate the question, right? Do I want the question unasked, right? What do I hope happens when I die? Do you mean that question, like, what do I hope people do? What do I hope whatever's left of my consciousness experiences? Where do you want that to go?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
I see. Yeah. So like I think a very big part of my story is that I hospiced both of my parents, like at their bedside day and night for months. Both had cancer. They died within 5 years of each other. So I saw the people who are like, biological, their biological child, like that's me, right? I'm them, right? Mm-hmm. Genetically, right? I saw how they died, right? As much as they saw how I was born, right? I saw how they died in like the most intimate and explicit detail. And I have every reason to believe that their process is likely to be my process.
And what was their process?
Well, they had cancer and then they died at home.
But cancer. The way in which that
saying is like, what do I hope happens when I die? It's like, I don't know that hope is like relevant for the way I think, because it's like, you know, if I don't get hit by a bus or shot in the face, that's how I'm going to die. And it's not about hope. It's about that. Like, that's what happens, you know?
Is there something about the way that they handled their deaths that you think you will share?
So your questions are deep and this is public, right?
Yeah.
And so I think about like, how much do I want the world, in particular, like the bad guys, to know about my fears?
Mm-hmm.
Right. But
I respect that. I'm not trying to feed your fears to the bad guys in any way.
No, I know. I also think that there's something to being like honest and open and, you know, like, you know me because my social media is public, right? Mm-hmm. I think what both of my parents experienced when they went through their, you know, their hospice, their death process was, among other things, they were holding my hand. I was there the whole time, right? Back and forth to the hospital and at home, you know, every day, and through like the, I'm blanking on the name of it now, the agitation that precedes, in like the last, the last day or so, mm-hmm. last couple of days. And then like last breaths, like I was there holding their hand. And let's see if I can say this without tearing up, but like they loved me and I love them. So what I can say about it is that it was shared. What they experienced was shared. And that's the part that I'm not sure about for me.
That you'll share it?
I guess what I hope for. Damn. This is I guess this is pretty hard to say aloud. Give me a second. I hope someone loves me as unconditionally as I did them in that way. Yeah. I mean, and I hope that they're okay through it and after it.
Are you okay through theirs?
I think that I wouldn't, there's no There's no version of my timeline in which I would want to not be there. There are aspects that I would change about, you know, the circumstances or the care that I gave, what I knew, but I would be there every time. Like, if I replayed it over and over again, my mom dying, my dad dying, I would be there. I would hold their hands. I would listen to their last breath every time.
Thanks for sharing that.
You made the questions.
I know, but I appreciate you, you know, going there. Do you want to take a little break?
Let's keep going.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay.
You know, just to take a beat, Irreversible Entanglements toured with Lonnie Holly.
Yeah.
Last year. It was great. I love him, and we had such a good time. And every time we'd all pile into the van, he would be like, let's get it done. Let's get it done. And that phrase has stayed with me. Like, whenever, like, you know, the alarm goes off and I got to get up and I got to wake my kid up and I got to get him to school. And it's like miserable outside. And, you know, I spent the entire night doom scrolling and I'm on like an hour and a half of sleep. And
yeah.
Like, let's get it done.
Totally.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get it done.
Right.
What's your coma? A moment of transformation, metaphorically. And it can be big or small. It does not need to be. I mean, I think if the shift is monumental, that's interesting. But the moment itself doesn't need to be super dramatic. But also, it can be if you want it to be.
So I thought about this one too. And I'm going to be 49 this year.
Congratulations. And
thanks.
On thanks. Making it.
Yeah. It feels more monumental than 50. Mm. And I'll tell you why. Because I have I'm not like a numerology guy, but I have some I don't know what it is. I have like some interest in the number 7. I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
And I also subscribe to this idea that the 7-year cycle is meaningful. Means something. I don't, you know, and it can be give or take. And I am completing the 7th 7-year cycle this year, right? So when I thought about like what's the equivalent for me of like the coma, the like thing that is really transformational in my life, I was a different person on either side of it. I feel like there are these columns, big columns, you know, like it's sort of like. You look like, what do you mean column?
I'm just curious.
That comes from studying composition in the Netherlands and the composer Louis Andriessen described musical form using the word column one time and it stuck with me and I have never really thought about it, but the way you sort of like cocked your head when I said column, I realized that needed some explanation. So anyway, you know, I think that there are, I don't know that there's one because I keep changing them. I keep,
yeah, of you course. Know? Yeah.
And, you know, we talked earlier about, the significance of like being 25, moving to the Netherlands, having my apartment ransacked and, 9/11, and becoming a debtor to the the educational loan company.
Yeah,
all happening in like the same like 2-3 week period. Right. That, you know, I was a different person on the other side of that. I went through like a real crisis. Mm-hmm. That was a big one. I think maybe more related to what got you to ask this question. What year was it? It was March 2021. I was in a really bad car wreck. It could have been really bad. But it's the only time that I was knocked unconscious in my life.
Wow.
Car spun out and flipped several times before landing on the passenger side, which is where I was sitting. And at one point during that, my head must have like bashed against the window and I was out. It's March 2021. I was actually accompanying a friend to he's a couple of years older than me, and he's eligible at that time for COVID vaccination. So we're sitting in the car, driving to get that done. And the reason that's relevant is like, cause nobody was vaccinated.
Right.
Very few people, elderly people, a couple of elderly people, March 2021. Right. So, we're like in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And, this was all related to me afterwards, but my friend was not knocked out. He was really banged up, but he got me out of the car, dragged me through the back window of the car, and like was holding me. And I guess another car pulled up on the highway. It was really super rainy. And we waited in the backseat of their car. Maybe there were masks involved. I don't know. Like, you know, that was like a fear, right? Mm-hmm. And then, I slowly woke up in the ambulance, and, you know, went to physical therapy. And a really important detail is that the day before the accident, I was on the phone for the first time in my life with a crisis hotline. Mm. I had no resources to deal with like the depression that I was going through at all. And then I was in this car accident that almost killed me. And I had to go through physical therapy to be back on my feet. It was also the first month that my ex-wife and I were living apart. So like we were becoming...
when it rains, splitting. It pours for you, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So coming out of that, I was on an SSRI for the year coming out of that, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think helped. It allowed me to know what my brain feels like when there's space to not be merely spiraling.
Yeah.
Right. And then physical therapy allowed me to figure out, you know, my body in a new way. Like, so at first I was afraid to pick up the saxophone, you know, like the right side of my body was black and blue. I had like a cracked rib. I was like, my brain was all shaken up, like a giant goose egg on my head. I was like, I'm staying alone at that point for half the week when I have my kid who was like six. And I'm afraid to pick up my saxophone because I don't want to injure myself further. And eventually the physical therapist was like, just pick it up for like 5 minutes a day. Mm. And what I was afraid of was actually, it was in picking up the saxophone that like my body knew how to be.
Yeah.
Right. So the whole time before I picked up the saxophone, I was like compensating. And because I was compensating, all my muscles were aching and I was like, you know, like holding myself in a weird way to like, you know, compensate against the pain and the, mm-hmm. you know, the bruising and whatever. When I picked up the saxophone, my body instantly knew what to do with itself.
Chills right now.
Cause you know, I started playing the saxophone when I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so through like physical therapy and, you know, playing the saxophone and really fucking wanting to play the saxophone, Jesus, you know, and like, and then like the SSRI that I was on that year, like I just started to figure out a way to be that I had never understood before. And it would like, the way I describe it is like creating like a space within myself that no one can touch. Nobody can touch. That is like I'm there and I'm like me and whole and untouchable. And like, you know, I'm like all the shit that I'm feeling in the last 19 months, over like, you know, the genocide in Gaza, I'm like able to feel it and express it and get up in the morning because there's a core. So, you know, like I visualize it as like a physical like manifestation, but it's, you know, it's just, it's psychological, right?
Yeah.
That like it's, I nothing gets in. And that has to be, and it's, you know, it's for, so that I can get through each day and so that I can be whole for my kid and, you know, useful to the world, you know.
How do you maintain it?
Right. It's a good question because I'm not on the,
thank you.
I'm not on the SSRI. I'm not currently in therapy, you know. Part of it is like knowing that I made it. I made this thing. And like, so like it's there, right? It's there. Like so your question isn't like, is it there? Your question is, how do I maintain it? And like, I guess I just try to stay linked to what helped me create it in the first place. Like, think about like my physical well-being, think about like my you know, my health, right? Take care of myself, be like proactive, you know, vices at bay, right? But also not in like, for me, I'm fortunate not to have like, you know, like addiction struggles. So like my vices are, you know, I shouldn't stay up late and eat like a tub of Ben and Jerry's.
Sure.
I shouldn't. So I don't, except when I do, you know, mm-hmm. And it's not good for me. Like I don't feel good the next day, but like, yeah. I'm able to not do that every day. Right. I know that's cute given like what vices could be. But you know, it's like, it's a matter of like, again, like just being able to be whole and useful the next day. And if like, you know, staying up late and eating ice cream every night, it would like knock me out, then I can't do that.
Yeah.
Or I will be knocked out. Right. But how do I maintain it? I don't know. I mean, I think about that one.
You've given me several good answers. You haven't like not answered the question.
I feel like I haven't answered it for myself, but we can move on.
Pick a single memory which you would relive if the afterlife consisted of the possibility to relive this one memory. The rest of your memories aren't wiped. It's like a room you can go into and out of whenever you want and relive one memory particularly vividly. What memory do you choose?
You don't think I'm going to answer that straightforward.
Well, you haven't tended to answer most questions straightforward, so I wouldn't guess, but you know, I'm open to being surprised.
Yeah. You know, and then again, like, I'm aware that that others are looking in on this conversation, right? And you know, I'm either gonna, you know, confirm or disappoint expectations by, like, it's not a memory of like being on stage or something like that.
Well, you're not summarizing your whole life. This is not a like determine. This is not a prioritize what's the most important to you. This comes from a bit in a one man show I did where I came up with the question backwards because I had the answer, and it was like rapping along to a Schoolboy Q song with a turkey sandwich in my mouth on the highway. That is not the thing I would choose to, but I was very purely happy in that moment. I remember the pepper I put on the sandwich, which felt like a nice touch. But if that frees you at all, I share that.
Yeah, no. The sort of sentimental, deeply honest, think about the question first and then, you know, find that answer. It's definitely going to be like, you know, my kid who's now 10, he's like, he would be like 2 and we would be like, you know, cuddling, snuggling, wrestling, like being funny, being playful, like just like super carefree, feeling in that moment like my heart is like completely open, and knowing that like he's achieved enough self-awareness to also be feeling super happy and super in love with me, and you know, like, sure. But there was a moment I had really recently, which, you know, is maybe a little bit more similar to that Schoolboy Q turkey sandwich situation you described, where it's like, why would I want this memory to replay over and over again? And so I recently linked up with this organization that they provide like free food and like personal necessities to people in the community here, like a mutual aid project. And
what's their name?
They're called No Más Lágrimas. And you know, like, I was aware of them existing, and I kept meaning to reach out and say like, oh, I know like you're looking for volunteers. I have a car, you know, if you ever need someone to go like pick stuff up or drop stuff off, I'm around, take my phone number. But the person who runs it, she's great. She like, I met her at a May Day rally, and I was like, hey, can you take my number in case you need like an extra pair of hands sometimes? She's like, walk with me. And we leave the May Day rally and we go, and the organization is like having a barbecue, and I go and I meet everybody, and everybody's so friendly and they feed me, and it's really sweet and nice. And then a couple of days later, she calls me and she's like, I have this idea that you might be a good fit for this thing we're going to do, this program for kids that we're going to do. And you said you're a musician, so maybe there's a way for you to, and I said, okay, let's meet up. I have a little bit of time, like an hour on Thursday. So I'll come in on Thursday. And so I go in on Thursday, and then like the memory that I want to answer your question with is like 2.5 hours later, I'm like shoulder deep in an industrial refrigerator, like scrubbing it so that it can be used to, you know, put the food in. And like, I don't know why it's filthy. Like, they have lots of refrigerators, but this one is like really nasty and needs to be cleaned. And I went to have a meeting about like being a saxophone player, right? And,
yeah,
you know, like, because, and I, you know, I had a half an hour to give, and like, 2 hours later, like I'm like just scrubbing, right? And she comes up to me, and we've only met two or three times, and she's like, "You look so happy," and that's not something that people often say about me.
Okay.
And I was just like, "Oh shit, I am." Like, I feel light. I feel really light right now, and so like, why not replay in my memory and like forever and ever, anytime I need it, like feeling light, feeling super happy, feeling seen in that happiness, right? Mm-hmm. Feeling useful, feeling like I belong, feeling connected, right? Like,
yeah. Was there a lot of thought preceding it? It sounded like you were really just like in your body and not like very thinky prior to this.
I think there are versions of me like 10, 20 years ago who would have been like, "I can't believe I don't have time for this." I said I had like a half an hour to like have a meeting and talk about, you know, how I'm going to like come in with my saxophone and play for the kids. Like that's what I can give, you know, but you know, that's not who I am anymore, you know? And I just, it was really organic. She was like, "Oh, okay." You know, when I got there, like, "Come, I have to do this thing over here." And then while we talk, and then the next thing I know, like I'm in the refrigerator, like scrubbing it. And like, you know, I don't know. Like it, yeah, it was super organic. It was like,
well, and what a gift to feel that kind of lightness while doing something at least a little bit selfless.
I mean, yeah, no, I think
of being of use in some way rather than like, and I was biting into a tiramisu, you know, or my like
a turkey sandwich
in fucking Schoolboy Q, you know, on the way to my own show. It's a little less of a, not that I really think like I'm a bad person and you're a good person in any way because of this, but like, but it's nice to have that when you're like, "Oh, I'm not doing this very noble thing for its nobility. For I'm not aware of myself in that way."
I should say that I've so actively and intentionally denied myself happiness so often in my life, in particular in public, but like just in general, that, you know, I don't think I'm better for that, and I don't think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's but it's true,
mm-hmm.
right? And like I know it, and it sucks. Like, and it's no fun, and I'm no fun, and so I think that's why it was like, I don't know, something shifted in that moment where like my happiness was apparent, and it's a good feeling, right? I would like to also have it sometimes when I'm just like listening to tunes and eating like a delicious food, because I like music and I like food,
mm-hmm.
and I like playing shows, right? So like something kicks in me when I'm like eating delicious food that I like, listening to music that I love on my way to music, which I love to do, and you know, brings me so much and hopefully share so much with other people, where like I'm not able to slip into like just abundant, open, pure joy in it. What the fuck? I don't know.
That is the show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Kier for coming on. Thanks to Kier for being a fucking cool, righteous voice online and in the world for radical politics and art. Thank you to Matt Sage for the show's art. And this is your Afterlife house band, Lake Mary, for the music. Speaking of music, go get Dromedaries and Alex Oterik's The Burning Bright Light album that came out this year. Visit patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife to support the show and get the premium feed. Follow This Is Your Afterlife on Instagram. Go to thisisyourafterlife.com for more info and email thoughts, questions, and preemptive eulogies to thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, you are a mist.